While the betrayal of the Arabs and the support of the British saw successive Muslim capitals falling, one city that still remained firmly in the Ottoman Khilafah's hands was Madinatul Munawwarah. With British support, an initial attack led by Sharif Hussein's son Faisal was launched against Medina in October 1916. It, however, was repelled by stiff Ottoman resistance. Arab rebel troops then besieged Medina from the north, south, and east. The defending commander of the Ottoman garrison in Medina was Omar Fakhruddin Pasha, who became renowned for his tenacious defend of the city of the Rasul sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Pasha also defended the Hijaz railway from sabotage attacks by T.E. Lawrence and his Arab forces, as it was essential for his supplies. As part of his defense, Pasha very early on prioritized sending the sacred relics of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and others in the city, as well as historical manuscripts, to Istanbul so that the enemy would not seize them. The Ottoman state withdrew from the war after an armistice was concluded on October the 30th, 1918. At that juncture, it was expected that Fakhruddin Pasha would also surrender, but he refused and did not surrender even after the end of the war, despite pleas from the Ottoman Sultan. He held the city until 72 days after the end of the war, becoming the last Ottoman commander to cede territory. So tight was the siege that soldiers and residents in Medina started suffering from hunger, thirst, and diseases. The price of grain skyrocketed and people were compelled to eat grasshoppers. Pasha was propelled in his actions by his intense love of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and concern for his radiant city. During the siege, he prayed constantly in the Rawda. On April the 2nd, 1918, Fakhruddin Pasha gave a Friday khutbah wrapped in an Ottoman flag and said, while indicating to the resting place of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, "O Prophet of Allah, I will never leave you." Facing capitulation everywhere, the Istanbul government ordered Pasha to hand over Medina to the Arab mutineers. He refused and was eventually replaced and detained. The siege on Medina lasted 2 years and 7 months and was one of the largest of its kind in World War I. For his steadfastness, Omar Fakhruddin Pasha was called Tiger of the Desert, and an inscription on his grave memorializes him as the heroic defender of Madinatul Munawwarah. The formal end of World War I was marked by the signing of the Treaty of Versailles with Germany on June the 28th, 1919. After the Treaty of Versailles, treaties with Austria, Hungary, Bulgaria and the Ottoman Khilafah were signed. However, the negotiation of the treaty with the Ottomans only truly reached finality after the Republic of Turkey was formed on the ruins of the Ottoman Empire and an agreement was reached in 1923 at Lausanne. Britain and France emerged victorious from the war, but the Arabs who supported them were given a raw deal as the Allied powers reneged on their promises for granting independence. An international meeting attended by the Prime Ministers of Britain, France and Italy, as well as representatives from Japan, Greece and Belgium, was held in April 1920 in San Remo, Italy, to decide the fate of territories formerly under the care of the Ottoman Khilafah. Following this meeting, the League of Nations awarded a mandate over Syria to France and a mandate over Iraq and Palestine to Great Britain. The Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan was created out of the Palestinian mandate. A product of the Sykes-Picot negotiations, this process set up a regional state system in an area where previously there existed a unified Ottoman administration. Borders were established without regard to natural or human boundaries.
Now, literally, they're gathered around a map and they're figuring out who's going to get the red, who's going to get portion A, who's going to get portion B, and they're arguing and they're drawing arbitrary lines here and there, and the modern Middle East is literally being carved out and argued over on a map and a table between the two or three of them. Each one is saying, no, this me, that me. Finally, the end map is in front of you. We still have the original map. And the only thing that comes to mind here is the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam reported in Musnad Imam Ahmad. It is only a matter of time. يُوشِكُ أَن تَتَدَاعَ عَلَيْكُمُ الْأُمَمُ. It's only a matter of time before the other nations will call one another to attack you. Just like people are called to eat from a common plate. Just like people are called to eat from one plate, they're going to be called to attack you. They're literally debating and negotiating who's going to get which share of the pie, which slice of the cake goes where. And eventually they agree to these arbitrary lines, and these arbitrary lines basically form the map of the modern Middle East to this day.
In 1918 and 1917, we started a process of a transition. The spirit and essence of the nation, which is called the Arab nation, was actually destroyed. And new essence was injected. Fake one, fabricated, not authentic, not organic, not normal, and not natural. Something that was imported and injected in the region. So the so-called Ummah, this nation, that has, until then, proper understanding of itself within the boundaries of a much bigger entity called the Ottoman Empire, or the Islamic Ummah at that time, has started to see itself in the shape and form of artificial borders that split and disintegrated this region into 22 or 23 or 21. It depends on when do you count and how much you count so-called sovereign states. They call them nation states.
In accordance with their new status as distinct territorial entities, the new countries established armies and adopted flags and anthems. However, these new states were not independent and rather remained proxies of Europe. In a painful irony, the flag of the Arab Revolt, which was designed by Sir Mike Sykes, went on to influence the design of flags of the emerging Arab nation states after World War I, such as Egypt, Jordan, Palestine, Iraq, Kuwait, Sudan, Syria, and the United Arab Emirates, Yemen, Somaliland, the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic, and Libya. For the ringleaders of the Muslim betrayal of the Ottomans, the emerging landscape after the war made for sordid reflection. Despite numerous assurances, the British had spectacularly betrayed their commitments to Sharif Hussein.
The legacy of World War One is treachery, and that's nothing that we talk about. We talk about it as if it's just, you know, some like thing that just needs to warm people's hearts.
The crumbs offered to Sharif Hussein were offering his sons the thrones of Iraq and Jordan under British supervision. France and Britain put down any anti-colonial revolts with brute force.
The Brits awarded themselves three territories. They get the lion's share, because they're the Brits. They get whatever they want. The first land, they called it Transjordan. And eventually Transjordan, in our map, it is Jordan, Palestine, and Israel. The second land is Iraq. They get all of Iraq. And the third land is Hijaz or Arabia. The Sharif of Mecca kept on clamoring, you promise, you promise, you promise. So they decided, okay, you know what, you're right, we did promise. So they took his three sons, and in one of the most bizarre things in recent history, they literally handed each one of the sons one of these lands. Yalla, go take it. Now obviously when they said this, it's understood the Brits are going to be the real puppeteers. These are figureheads and they know it. And so the eldest son of Sharif Hussein, his name was Ali. Ali was given the Hijaz. You get Arabia. And immediately Ali called himself the king of Hijaz. And he ruled that very long rule from October 1924 to December 1925. Very long rule. Because obviously there was another power brewing in that region, and that is the power of the Al Saud, the Saudis, who were also financed by the British, unbelievably. As they're financing the Sharifs, they're also financing the Al Saud. And I know this is painful for some of us in the audience, but the haqq is the haqq here. Okay? That as they are financing them, they're also financing the other group. Right? And it is now well known. I mean, you cannot deny this. The documents are quite there. Right? And it's it's surreal. How many groups are you financing? What are you instigating with whom? And eventually, when Al Saud becomes more and more powerful, the Brits basically absolve themselves of the Sharif, Ali ibn Sharif Hussein, and they allow Al Saud to basically unify Arabia, and the Al Saud then call the country their own, and they say it is the kingdom of Saudi Arabia. The second oldest son of Sharif, his name is Abdullah ibn Sharif Hussein. He is given Jordan. He is given Jordan. And that is the only one of the three who, Allah's Qadr has it, was successful in his own way. And he proclaims himself the king of the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. Hashemite because he's Hashemi in lineage, right? And eventually, his grandson Hussein becomes the king. And Hussein was the king from 1952 to 1999. And then he died. And currently it is Hussein's son Abdullah. And so the current king of Jordan is the great-great-grandson of the Sharif Hussein of Mecca. Otherwise, the Hashemite king of Jordan has absolutely nothing to do with Jordan. He is from Mecca. The third of the three was the youngest, Faisal. And Faisal was the most friendliest to T.E. Lawrence. And Faisal was made governor of Iraq. And he immediately calls himself the king of Iraq. MashaAllah, we got three kings, three brothers. All of them wanted to be kings. There's king here, king here, king there.
Having supposedly freed themselves from the Ottoman brothers, the consequences of nationalism and betrayal were now laid bare to the Arab revolters.
This destructive way of doing things in nationalism is something that was embedded in the Muslim world after this. So Arab was set against Turk. You know, the idea that, you know, that this thing about Arab and Turk didn't exist for hundreds of years under the Khilafah. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the Arabs were taught, you must hate the Turk. And this terrible nationalism started with that. And then you've got, you know, more localized nationalism. So you've got, you know, Egyptian nationalism, and Syrian nationalism, Iraqi nationalism, and each of the Gulf states having their own pride in their own kingdoms, which are, you know,
small localities and provinces.
Absurd sort of thinking like that.
They were one, but now, because of a new idea, an idea which contradicts La ilaha illallah Muhammadun Rasulullah, an idea which contradicts unity, an idea which contradicts what came from Islam, they started to have problems.
Far from securing their own prestige, siding with the enemy at the expense of Islamic Ukhuwa put the entire Ummah, Arab and Turk, in jeopardy.
The consequences of betrayal, the consequences of forsaking a Muslim. Now, what happens is, they thought that by doing that, they're securing themselves. But the thing is, they don't realize that it will come to you next. You will be next in line. So brothers, if you want to protect yourselves, now we're not talking about doing anything for your brother that is down. If you want to protect yourselves, you need to stop that. You need to stop such things from happening. Because as soon as you allow one Muslim to be taken, Allah Azza wa Jal does not help you anymore. You lose the assistance, the awn of Allah Azza wa Jal. If we betray or forsake, if we forsake a Muslim who is in need today, Be assured that Allah Azza wa Jal will forsake us tomorrow.
Before the war, the Ottoman Khilafah had maintained a relatively impressive level of peace and stability throughout the Middle East. With their fall, power vacuums developed and conflicting claims to land and nationhood began to emerge. Of the promises made by the British at the time, only the commitment to the Zionist movement was faithfully fulfilled. Through that facilitation of the creation of Israel and the concurrent carving up of the Ummah, a recipe for chaos was brewed, whose consequences are all too clear to see in the story of the past 100 years.
So, you have, apart from the dhulm, the oppression that is meted out on the people, you actually have a bunch of states which are all very weak, all very immature, they don't know how to govern themselves, they're all divided by artificial lands, they're all fighting over what border. The ruler that's been put there isn't even respected by the people. What chance has that got to succeed? You're basically setting up a region full of failed states. Divide and rule. Yeah, that word divide and rule comes from British foreign, understanding British foreign policy, really, doesn't it? I mean, that is effectively what's happened. So when one government in a particular country would weaken, sometimes those colonial powers would do a coup to replace it with another one of their clients. Sometimes it would be a rival colonial power to replace it with a client. Yeah, and slowly the region, you know, you had this conflict, and this is what we see today. And you think of the worst conflicts in the Middle East today, the terrible atrocities in Yemen, Syria, the what happened in Iraq in the last few years, the ongoing problems in occupied Palestine. There is a line from these things right back to this war.